Thank you. I'm Kim Schneppen, and I come from the Center for Models of Life, which is not a modeling bureau, but it's a place where we do a mathematical physical model of living things. And one of the things we work a lot with is phages, and that's what I will tell you about today. And I will give you kind of a little overview of what you can do in phages and why we think it's fun to work with phages as physicists. So it's together with a number of people, of which in particular Ian Dodd and Barry Egan and Adam Palmer and Keith Sherwin is actually phage biologist that has worked all their life in some of these phage systems. So we have some facts to base our sometimes quite fantasy-based models on. And maybe give a little introduction that this phages is maybe small stuff, but they are actually running the system here. As a meaning the whole system, the world basically. So the number of humans is not so large at the planet. The number of bacteria is slightly larger. And the number of phages is roughly like a factor 10 times larger than this. The bacteria is responsible for around half of the carbon cycle on the planet. And they are kind of regulated in turn by phages. The typical death reason for bacteria is to run into a phage that kills it. Like half of the bacteria dies due to this reason, and the other dies due to being eaten by other stuff. So they're kind of not a detail, even if they're small. Let's see some pictures of bacteria and phages. This is some bacteria, you've seen many of them. Phages are like kind of quite mathematical small objects, and they're not only mathematical in the sense that they are nice hexagons or whatever, but they are actually kind of very digital small computers that do quite precise things, and that's kind of this feature that we are happy for working with when we are physicists. It's not so soft as biology on our scale. It's very close to be a real kind of computer-like. Here's some pictures of phages. There's some bad phages, bad meaning violent phages. So phages comes in two classes, and the first I will show you a little model where we try to address this, and actually don't get any conclusions out of it, but anyway, I think we learned something. We learned that it's a complicated world and that there's questions we could raise that we have to think more about. And this is two phages, which are so-called virulent phages. And when they go into a bacteria, it's bad luck for the bacteria, it's going to be killed. It's a T2 phage and this is the T4 phage. And actually this T4 phage, I think the code protein of that phage is the most abundant protein you find in the oceans. So it's not a detail not exactly the T4, but the T4 class phage. So it's not details. They infect bacteria. Here there is two bacteria that are quite unlucky. They're not only infected by one phage. One phage is enough to kill them. This is kind of some funny picture they have made where they have infected them by many phages. So they're going to be killed many times when it's this kind of phages. However, yeah? Here, just to ask questions. There's other phages, which are kind of more interesting because they kind of have a brain. And that's the temporal phages, which are basically going into the bacteria, and then they make a little computation. And then they might either kill the bacteria, or they might leave the bacteria, integrate that DNA into the bacteria and stay there forever. And for some phages, we kind of have quite good numbers for this here. For example, for the lambda phage, it's such that if there's two phages infecting simultaneously, then it always goes neutrogenic. If there's only one, it always goes lytic. So that's kind of a nice little digital features of that organism. It can kind of count. How that was shown? That was Kurilsky that showed you vary the it's back from the late 70s. He vary the density of phages. You plot how often you get a lysogen, and you see that the number of lysogen goes perfectly like the square of the density of phages. It doesn't go like linear; it goes square, and it doesn't go like third power. And it's very nice over kind of three order of magnitude. So it really leaves very little left over for. There's been a lot of nonsense about this phase where people have said that it's actually kind of very stochastic, this decision. It doesn't. Somehow the original data basically say it's deterministic. So that's Well, there's many worlds, many things has been said about the original data. I know that there's some data that say something like that, but then now I go back to some more hardcore published data that actually, but it's discussed. I think this is reasonably true. So now I will try to work on phages on three different levels to show you that they actually can provide models or way of thinking about life on three different scales. And the most somehow superficial scale, we would say, because ecosystems is kind of superficial. Nobody knows really anything about ecosystems. And in particular, they know nothing about ecosystem of phages. We will dare anyway to make a model of ecosystem of phages. And that would be an ecosystem is kind of like some phages are doing something on some other something they eat. So there's bacteria, that's the food source of the phages. And then there's two types of phages, there's virulent phages and there's temporal phages. And you can set up a little model for that. You could write a lot of equations with a lot of Voltaire stuff. We don't like to do that because then you drown in parameters. Each coupling in a lot of Voltaire equation involves all kind of exponential growth, and exponential growths are in general not true anyway. It's only true in very short and limited settings. But the main point is that we kind of believe, and that's probably wrong, but let's start that. We believe that when a phage infects a bacteria, it's bad for the bacteria. That's the overall setting for this type of models. And then we try to predict one single experimental fact. Unfortunately, people has not measured very much about this system. The only thing they know is that when you sample somewhere in the sea or somewhere in the soil, you find tempered phages, you find virulent phages, and you find bacteria. So you find coexistence for all these three things. So we should kind of get out of our modeling that was kind of easy to get some coexistence between these three different features. And so then we start doing some modeling. We of course kind of cannot make it parameter free. Would like to do it, but we're trying to make it as close as possible. And a phage is kind of not infecting any kind of bacteria in the world. Each of the phages are infecting a few bacteria. That's a first basic observation that basically is believed to be true. Phages are kind of very specific because they have receptors, they have some certain kind of needle or that they have to stick on the surface of the bacteria. The surface of the bacteria has some receptor protein, so they have some particular sugar structure that kind of matches this. So the phage cannot be prolific and attack everything. So it's a fairly specific link from here to some bacteria species. So this is a species or strain of phage, and this is a species or strain of bacteria. The whole group, which might be 10 to the 15 bacteria here, and there might be 10 to the 17 phages of that type. In some kind of settings that we don't specify because it's kind of ohm. And there's virulent phages and there's temporal phages. And we kind of guess that if you are virulent phage, you are actually more evil than if you are temporal phage. Because when you infect the bacteria, you kill it. So the main thing in the model is that we put load on the bacteria due to these two links. And there's two different loads. There's a load here and there's a load there. And then in addition, so there's a load of strong and weak links, which we don't really know. Of course, it would be good for the phage to have this load as small as possible, because then you don't kill the bacteria. A load on the bacteria means that the chance to kill it at the next time step is larger. So that's one ingredient in the model. Two loads, strong and weak links. And then the other ingredient in the model is that you have to, when you kill things, remove things, drive things extinct, then you also have evolution, you copy things. Evolution is basically the kind of a copying. You copy whatever, you copy a bacteria. When you copy something, you basically retain most of its properties and make a little mutation around it. And here, we just at each time step, we copy always one bacteria, and then there's a relative rate of mutation of virulent phages and temporal phages. And then you run the model. So there's two mutation rates or duplication rates, one of this and one of this, and then there's two load parameters. Yes?
Sorry, doing model mitigation rates as regular changes of parameters?
No, we don't really change parameters at all. In running a given simulation, we don't change parameters. We scan, but we kind of, what we change is that we change the links, who you are connected to. The mutation is that you duplicate, and then when you duplicate, you always retain everything you had before, and then you add or remove a link. That's basically kind of, that's a simplified scenario for that. And
what you make new, so when you do a mutation, how do you actually create a new link?
You just copy, take or the new link. See, there's a detail here. That's true. And you could just take a random link and put it everywhere. I take a link from this, like this phase duplicate, and it takes a link somewhere else. Oh shit. Yes.
But that's not
the full story, because that is maybe somewhat unreasonable, because where should this phage know how to attack some bacteria which is far away in the ecosystem? So we have a parameter, a fifth parameter, which does not really matter so much for our, but that is basically to what extent are you, when you copy something from when you get a new link, you could get it from meeting another phage inside the bacteria. If this phage and this phage both are infecting this one, then this one could meet this phage inside and steal some of its repertoire and then copy the link from there. So that you could have a more or less local coupling. And that's, it's not true that this should be completely, but that, now I'm going into technical details, but that's something one could think about. And but it's really completely without any experimental kind of support directly what that value of that parameter should be.
But has there been any experimental data on, say, you have a population of bacteria and you have some phages that infect them, and now you get mutations in the phages or in the bacteria, and then you look again sort of like cross infection?
No, there has been very, very, actually on mutation scale with phages, there has been some people has gone out and measured in the soil, and they have gone on 14 days after and measured another population in the soil and seen that a lot of things has happened. But doing experiments on this here has not been done, which is kind of a shame. It's a lot of interesting stuff that could be done. So this is kind of building models into a world where you don't really have the data yet. There's one thing which is somewhat important here, and that is that we put in links also, or the possibility for links, that two phages can interact with each other. And that is a fact, phages interact with each other. They meet each other in the bacteria, and tempered phages are somewhat good for the bacteria because they often provide proteins that protect them against the virulent phages. So even if they maybe provide some load on the bacteria, then in the same go, they also come with some protein that prevent another virulent phage, actually also tempered phage, but here it's important, the virulent phage, it prevents this virulent phage from coming in. And there's a number of examples of this. Phage P2 prevents this three bad phages from entering. Phage RB69 is preventing this tree. It's not possible to do a system here because this is anecdotal. You have to go and ask with people, and you get a few stories here and there, and you cannot build a real network from that. But there exist a dozen or so stories of this type. Yes?
You said that the phage can interact inside the cell. Can they interact outside the cell also?
I don't think so. No, I would say no, because they, outside the cell, they are just they are kind of crystal. They are just a DNA in a little protein capsule, and they the DNA is inert. They don't have any of the proteins. They don't have anything to interact with. That should be if the two surfaces of the phage is just sticking to each other. So that could maybe happen, but I think that's nobody would really be. That's I think very low. So, immunity?
There's specificity between the phage and the host bacterium.
Yeah.
How can you estimate, sort of in the wild situation, what this relationship, the numbers are between the phage and the bacteria?
How specific they are?
Yeah.
Well, you can see whether I think it's in the moment, it's kind of like an on-off. Either it can infect or not or not infect. Now, how specific it is would also it depends on. Well, I don't think you should think about it as chemistry and binding energies. I think if they can do it, they actually stick, and it's a fairly, when they first stick, they don't go off again. So it's not, and somehow diffusion for phage coming in and so on, they stick. I think it would be a kind of quite a lot on off. And if it sticks, if the phage do the mistake to stick to a bacteria, which is bad for it, which it maybe can stick to, but when it injects its DNA, there are some other proteins inside that prevent the DNA from doing what it's supposed to do, then it's just bad luck for the phage and it's out of the game. So you put in all this here and you run it. And the main thing here, I'll not go into details, this is a very sketchy, it's a model on the first stages, and overall conclusion of this model is that we kind of fail. We have now 4 or 5 parameters depending on this locality of move, and we want to get coexistence. And we can get coexistence if we kind of cheat. And the cheating is that we have to kind of make a mutation or make a doubling of each variant phage at each time we make a doubling of each of the template phage. If we now let these two things kind of compete with each other, such that a doubling, if there's 10 times more virulent phages than template phages, then there will be 10 times larger duplication rate of the virulent phage. And that would be reasonable. If we do that, we kind of fail to get coexistence. Whatever parameter we choose, it's kind of choosing either only template or only virulent phages. It's a model where all links are kind of penalizing.
Every bacterium,
there's
any space in
it. There's no space. So that could be something one could discuss here. I tend to think that maybe that's a feature. It's one of the features. Other features that I kind of think about here is that links could be positive, that phages are not only predating on the bacteria, phages could provide positive things to the bacteria. That's what I'm tending to believe, that is. So template phages in the moment, like the last 2 years actually, there has been data where it turns out that lambda phage is modifying the metabolism of E. coli. And that could be, so there can be games that's where this is positive.
But here you don't have this immunity link?
Oh yeah, you have the immunity link, which is, but that's not enough. It's not enough. It helps to get template phages. I get the reason for the template phage, but it's not enough to get it. So that was one of the attempts to rescue it, but it's not enough.
Is it not possible that in the soil, the virulent phage are associated with one type of bacteria and template phage with another type?
Oh yeah. But that's what I'm in some way. That's what I'm allowing for here. So the whole thing in writing a network. So then when you write something like that, a network here, this here means that this one is attacking this one. This virulent phage is attacking that one. That they are different. So that is also possible in the model. When you write a network model, you're not assuming everybody interacts with everybody. That's important. You are
different kind of bacteria.
Oh yeah, sure. But this is supposed to be a different kind than this one. That part we have with us, but there is a spatial part we don't have, and I don't know how whether that could be put in a right way. Okay.
One species of the virulent can only attack one type of bacteria?
Well, of order one type of bacteria.
Why is that?
Well, it can attack, often it can somewhat more. They tend to specialize. Well, you see in the model they will attack more, and that will depend on our load. In reality, why is that? Well, it's probably something about if you attack many, the bacteria will probably try to prevent itself from being attacked. So you try to make a universal attack, then it's your kind of two. Of course, it would be advantage for the phage to attack as many as possible. For the bacteria, it would be advantage to.
You think that the phages try all the time to increase.
Of course, they would. That's what we obviously include here. Yes? Oh, yeah, sure. So when a phage mutates, it typically. The only links we typically take a copy of the old one and then we add a new link. Meaning that it then increases its well, that's it. From now you're talking about the data. What do people know from the interactions, and people know something. It's not that much they know. So I don't know order one. I say that it's not somehow prolific. Phages are not believed to be prolific in the data. And it's not that I if there was that then it would be fine, but then I just think they're not.
Are there some types of phages that people have to
learn? Oh, I don't know. Probably it's for cola, probably it's 100 or something like that. But there's many. Actually, it's a trivial thing to find a new phage. You can kind of let your student go out and find a phage and then characterize it and put it in the team, and that's a good bachelor project or master project. It's incredibly easy to find. It's somehow more difficult to find the same phage again. So the lambda phage was actually only found once. It was a little bit, so that's kind of the paradigm of molecular biology, and it turns out they found it once, and it was actually not having the right properties. It gave two small plaques, which is the way you look at it, so they re-engineered it. So people are studying a paradigm which is actually an engineered paradigm that was found one time in one fridge someplace. But you have found huge, another complex time, you find huge classes of, so the lambdoid phage is a huge class of phages. And that counts like 40% of phages that attack E. coli. Yeah?
Isn't it very difficult to define?
Oh yeah.
It's not a species.
Absolutely, it's devastatingly difficult. And it's not that I saw strange species. I'm wobbly here. What does it? Because you don't have a hierarchical ancestry. It's a mixture. Phages are meeting and they're exchanging part of their genome. They're swapping their immunity region with each other. And then their immunity region is the region that decides what a phage is providing immunity against for the bacteria against other phages, and they can do all kinds of swapping with each other.
But they're not, by definition, they're not living, right?
Whew, that's up to you. I'm not God here. You can decide. It's a more matter of taste whether you call it. They don't have a metabolism.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
But all the other properties it have.
Okay. Maybe I'm missing something, but when you do the sampling, mm-hmm. You say you find both of them, so they coexist.
Yeah.
Is there some notion of how much of a history you sample in terms of time?
Very little. People are typically, when you go in, people have not sampled very many. You find less than 100 papers, more of order 10, 20, 30 papers in literature where people have bothered to sample. And then the soil, sometimes for soil and sometimes in the ocean. And they sometimes, in a few of these papers, they actually sampled several times in the same place and then seen that a lot of stuff was happening in between these samplings. But it's
Shallow time people are sampling?
I think things are happening quite fast here.
So you don't think that maybe when you're seeing you're seeing both of them coexist, it could have been that one was existing almost exclusively at one time and it's left the historical imprint and then the other one kind of comes back and wins another time and then you see a coexistence, but it's
over. No, I don't think so, but it's it could be that you could come into locality and how do you sample and so I'm not sure here. That's up to kind of open philosophy. Let me be a little bit more. So basically, conclusion of the first little exercise was that we could make a nice little model. We could think a little bit about it, and we could try to do. We really experimented a lot with essentially all parameters, all parameter ranges, and we kind of failed in the moment. And we are kind of thinking why and how to go a little bit further. So that was kind of negative, but it's nice to try to face some of the more existential problems in this field. Going a little bit deeper, as I throughout the talk, I will go deeper and deeper and to more and more fact-related modeling. And this is then going into temporal phages and that networks in phages. So that's more where what you have been discussing here when you talk about networks. So a network in phage consists of proteins which are expressed when the phage is inside the bacteria. And there's two classical phages here. Lambda phage, which is very famous, and 1A6 phage, which is not very famous. And both of them has been characterized quite detailed. Essentially, one knows molecular network on the scale of positive and negative links. Red is positive links, negative links, and green is positive links. And when a protein has a negative red links to that one, it means that this protein repress the existence of that protein in the cell, in one way or the other. Most of these links are kind of transcriptional, but there's also some other stuff, like protein degradation and small RNA, there's a few small RNA links in the lambda. So there's a little bit of everything that you also know from modern biology. So these two phages are kind of similar when you look at it like this here. So that was the first, so we just compare these two phages. They are similar when you look at these two, and we can actually devise a metric which is capturing that they are similar. But just visually, they have a core of some proteins here and some input coming in, some computation here, and then they have some output coming that way. And they have a little bit of output coming down there. Some input here, some computation in here. The computation is a little bit larger. Well, this three things is a computational unit here. This three things is maybe four things is a computational unit here. And then there's some decision spreading out here. So that's the overall design. So maybe they are related. Actually, they are not at all related. And they are not only not related in the sense that you don't find any proteins here which is similar to any of the proteins here, that you do not. You also, when you now go into the next level, so that kind of this protein sequence similarity is kind of the most basic level of comparing something. You can also go into the next level and compare what's actually happening. How does it implement its links? So the way that you do some regulation here. And one fun little thing here is that you kind of know that reg A, probably you are talking about evolution, so reg A is kind of important here. It's something about DNA damage and repair of DNA damage. It's like bind to single-stranded DNA and do stuff in that connections. And then it gets activated, and then it degrades C1. So reg A, UV radiation, sends a signal to reg A. Reg A degrades C1. C1 does not repress Q. Q is making the head and tail of the phage, and the phage kind of escape and kill the bacteria.
But C1 and C2, they're just basically the same label on completely different.
They are completely different proteins, and they have very different functions. Well, they have very similar. They are both related to keeping the good side, as I was going to say, to being in what's called isogen, the dormant state of the phage.
Well, C1 because they have the same function, but they're not related at the sequence.
No. It's not. It's because they both are giving in absence. When you remove them from the phage, then they give so-called clear plaques. That means that it kills that the phage will kill everything it enters into. So you make a separate phage lytic by removing this or removing that. And it will just go into, actually there's also a C3 somewhere here. If you remove any of them, then when the phage enters the bacteria is dead. It's only when all three are present that actually stays. From the phage. So you can make a phage where you delete that one, or you delete that one, or you delete that one. In that case, the phage, when it enters the bacteria, is just going to kill it. So all three are involved in being. But the main thing here, what you learn from this here, is in part that actually a signal is sent across a network. And it's kind of maybe even this very smallest system, in particular when you look at this system here, is that a signal is also sent across from this to this proteins over there. So the reg A here, it repairs lex A. When reg A is kind of activated, it cleaves lex A. Lex A then doesn't repress TOM. TOM doesn't repress C1. C1 comes up. TOM repress C1, and that's kind of complicated. So the main thing is that there's a whole pathway here with a minus, a minus, a minus. Three times minus. Here there's one times minus. And in effect, there comes the same signal from here to here as from here to here. So you kind of, what you are learning is that, well, you can replace one minus with three minuses. And it basically do the same. They are both inducible by UV radiation at somehow roughly similar strengths. The way the interaction is implemented is here you have a cleavage of C1. Here you have a protein TOM that is kind of expressed and bind to C1 and kind of prevent it from doing whatever it's doing. So it's different mechanism.
Is this response related to the integration of the virus in the bacteria?
It responds to the
Reg A response.
To Reg A normally respond to UV radiation, any DNA damage. make reg A activate.
But does the virus trigger that when it tries to integrate?
No, no. This is about the exit of the virus. In the entry, so when it go into the, then it's a different logic. You're not really asking about the input from here. Then you're just coming into the cell, and you kind of express this protein and this protein and this protein, and there's a fight between these proteins. And in this case, between these three proteins that decide whether it is going into the neutrogenic or the lytic state. So it's two different part of some logical decision. So it's different mechanisms. It's not only different sequences, but it's also different mechanisms. And then, apart from that, then there's a kind of nice little logic with 3 times minus is equal to 1 times minus, and if you use that, you can actually kind of devise some kind of measure that kind of quantify that these two things are fairly close to each other.
So when you compare the two, mm-hmm. you know, you get any ontology?
No, you get one little ontology, that's the integrase, which has to do with integrating. Nothing. But but what I'm saying is that there's also a higher level where there's and I'm not now going to describe a higher level in the core of the brain here and here that really is different. And that's kind of how I would, yes?
So, just to follow up on this point, so even though these two things have the same name, they're completely different.
Absolutely.
There's no structural similarity.
No, it has a helix turn helix binding motif in the DNA binding domain, both of these C1s, but that's kind of.
What I'm wondering is, are they like extremely diverged from the same ancestors, and they're only maintaining structural similarity, but not identifying the sequence similarity, or are they actually, you think, like just sort of coming from different?
I think they are so divergent as you kind of can be, but I don't know whether there was one phage in the beginning. Or there was two, I don't know, but you cannot see any. And we're talking about enormous time scale, so they have kind of in the end settled for two different solutions. So where I would go to. Well, if this is the same solution on network level, now I will go to describe where it's different on somehow a level between the network and the structure. So as soon as I go deeper, it's like when I look at it, a network is kind of a superficial way of looking at things. When you go somewhat deeper, then you see some more details, then you go down to sequences, and then you're lost in bits. So I kind of want to go this intermediate step.
They both infect
the coli. Yes.
Do they have the same structure? They have the same kind of
head? No, they don't have the same head. This head is smaller than this one. It's a smaller genome. This is like 38 kilobase and this is 49. But that's a small difference somehow compared to.
Still a
lambdoid. No. That's actually the main part. Good, you said it. Actually, this here is a P2-like phage, and this is a lambdoid. Together, they cover 90% of the E. coli phages.
But I guess the issue is that you were talking about the phylogeny of phages. Mm-hmm. But to what extent do phages or viruses, for that matter, have phylogeny?
Yeah.
To what extent they may have?
Yes.
And that's to what extent they're just orgiastic and
yes.
Mosaics.
Yes.
And I guess the issue here that you cannot take B from a T phage
yeah.
and put it to replace
yes.
Q with a.
Yes.
Within the lambda
yes.
phages,
yes.
you will have
that's
the
true.
Same situation, but they will be
yeah.
replaceable, right?
That's true. It's kind of true. Yes, exactly. They are different superclasses somehow. And anyway, yeah. So they one is P, what is called P2-like, and the other is lambdoid-like.
Even within the same class, within lambdoids,
there would also be
different flavors of on the level of, you know, you will
yeah.
not be able to recognize orthologs of Q.
Yeah.
Yet you
yeah.
will be able to take something
yeah.
which
yeah.
is superficially very different, like
yeah.
on a sequence level, very different from Q, and replace
yes. Yes.
Q with it.
Yeah, actually, this is an anti-terminator. This is a normal transcription factor. So it's kind of also, it's really different. So that is.
So I guess the question is, are there any phages that share components from these two?
I have no examples of that. So, but that does not mean that they don't, you know, with a few hundred phages maybe, sequence then, and but you this is believed to be kind of two different classes.
But actually, how about
C1? C1 is two different. The only thing that is in similar. I will talk a lot about C1 now because we kind of the C1 here is a classical textbook example of genetic regulation. How C1 is a kind of dimer that binds to the DNA and recruit RNA polymerase, and then you have transcription by activation by recruitment. That's a classical story. And this here is a completely different story. And that story I will try to tell you now. So that's actually, so I will kind of go a little bit deeper. And that's what I'm doing here. So I go to the brain of these two phages, the core of the brain. And the lambda phage is exactly as I told you. You have an operator region that you probably have read about, since you are all kind of physicists going into biology. You will probably have read Dashnik's book somehow about the lambda phage and three binding sites, and things are binding somewhere here, and C1 comes around, and then it activates and binds and activate the RNA polymerase by recruit. So that's a kind of standard story. And there's a C1 here and the close here. Shooting I draw, and the promoters are sitting opposite to each other with C1 coming and blocking this one. If Crow comes, it goes up and blocks this one, and then you have a bistable situation. One thing blocks the other, and the other thing blocks the first, and that gives bistability. That's what people tell you, and maybe some of it is true. Then on that somewhat, so now in 186. This is at least true. This orientation is very true. In 186, it's a little bit different. Actually, it's completely different. These two promoters sit something like this here. So the good guy sits over here and has to fire through the bad guy. And the bad guy sits and fires this way. There's no transcription by activation by recruitment at all. This one is making a C1 protein that comes and binds and prevents this promoter from firing. So actually, what really happens is that this transcription activation by recruitment here is represented by a double negative. Because this promoter in itself is preventing this one from firing, because it fire RNA polymerase through it and throw off each time RNA polymerase bind here, it has a big chance to be kind of ejected from RNA polymerase firing through here. So this is data that is collected by Ian Dodd and Barry Egan and Callan in Adelaide. And you can actually do this experiment very detailed. You kind of basically put this PR, and you remove PR, and you put back PR, and then you put a reporter over there, and then you see how much this one fire. And you see without it having any transcription factors. And you just see that this one is six times more active when this one is not there than if it is there. So they kind of, this one tends to annihilate that one. And then this one, on the other hand, makes a protein that comes back and binds and kind of annihilate this one's annihilation. And as a function of that, well, that's a lot of stuff. Then you kind of get, so this is Ian Dodd's experiment, which is all this work here I've done together with Ian. That is the activity of PL. So here you have PR and PL. The good side over here and the bad side over here, which is called Apple, which is the Crow version in this system. And then there's a C2 over here, which you have removed and placed some reporter gene there sometimes and or another reporter gene there. And then you kind of measure what happened. And in contrast to Lambda, where people did in vitro experiments, then this is completely in vivo experiments. And what Ian does is that you measure, for example, the activity of PL in a normal PR plus strain as function of C1. You have removed C1 here and you have removed Apple there. So that's not in the system anymore. But then you supply C1 from outside and titrate it with IPTD and that's a technique to add a little bit more or less C1. That's what you do here. And then you see how active PL is as function of C1. And you see some curve that when there's no C1, then PL is so active. And then it gets, whereas in contrast, if there was PR minus, so that's the black curve. The black curve here is a function of C1. The black curve here is a function of C1. And then you have different mutants. So one, this standard wild type situation you have, the activity of PL is going up and then coming down. So this is kind of looking like the lambda phage. It's activation by recruitment in lambda, where you put in a little bit C1, and the
promoter
gets activated by that, effectively. So that's what's happening, and the ratio between that number here, which is like 13, and this number, which is like 80, that's when you have PR minus. That was what I talked before. That's a factor 6. That the effect of, yes?
In the first case, is it a direct somehow, is it recruitment or is it preventing something?
It's not recruitment. I was just saying it was similar. This is definitely not recruitment. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that.
Was it actually preventing the PR from
firing? Yes. That's what's happening. It's preventing the PR from firing. And what I would like to do now is to build a model how it prevents PR from firing, and do that somehow in a consistent. And that I can do because Ian has done a lot of experiments here. This system is a little bit complicated, so there's a lot of curves. And the curve I will focus on in this talk is actually kind of a subpart of this data set. That's just because there's binding sites here and out there. So you have binding sites for C1 here, you have binding sites somehow 300 base pair that way, and you have binding sites out there 300 base pair. And all this means something. That's kind of the different mutants there. That means that whatever happened is something with DNA bending around and making twists and little knots on itself. So it's a hugely entangled system of DNA knots and some structure. And that's too complicated for a 10-minute talk, or whatever talk this here is, that demands some longer time. So I will concentrate just on this system and look at the FL minus and FR minus, which is making it somewhat simpler to analyze. And that's kind of what we have down there in the red curve, which looks a little bit like the black curve, it just has less amplitude. And that's a red curve over here. And that's another red curve here, which is PR activity here, when there's PL, that doesn't really matter. So that's kind of, this three red curves is kind of what we should relate to. So that was kind of what I'd say, and the core of understanding this modeling or understanding the system is that there is a gain between RNA polymerase and RNA polymerase, and that's a major part of the regulation. RNA polymerase is itself an active player in regulating itself and neighboring RNA polymerases. To understand that, then I will try to first make a very sketchy model of how two RNA polymerases actually can do something with each other. And the main thing is that RNA polymerase, when it binds to DNA, it does not immediately start to transcribe. The RNA polymerase bind and unbind, that's an equilibrium process. Then it goes into an open complex, which is non-equilibrium step, and then it can sit there for some time, and then from there it can go to elongation where it just runs along. So there's two non-equilibrium steps. If it's kind of in this open complex, it's sitting there and needs to sit there for some time, then it's vulnerable and can be ejected by RNA polymerase from the other side. And that you can write a little equation for, which is kind of the level of physics normally, and the main model is that what comes in goes out. It's a usual transport equation. Here is a promoter, and this is RNA polymerase in some absurd deformed state. RNA polymerase come in here on this promoter with some input rate, which is on rate, which is kind of like the on rate to go into this open complex, effectively. And then the chance it can come in and do that is 1 minus R, the occupancy. If it is occupied already, it cannot come in. So that's the input, and the output is then the firing rates times sitting here in the open complex. And then there's some balance here. That's the standard model, simplified model for firing from a single promoter, the two-step process. And a little correction make it to a three-step process, but that's the main feature. If you then come and fire with some strong promoter over there, which is what's happening in this system, the one promoter is 10 times stronger than the other, so it fire over there, then you basically have to kind of think about that the output is coming out there, but there's a certain chance that when you fire there, that that this one is going to be ejected. So you have to add to this one some K, which is whatever comes from over there. And then you get a modified equation, which this term production is kind of smaller than this production here. I have divided by a plus k down there. And that the difference between these two situations is kind of giving you how much effect there is on this. So I will not tell you more about that, but the main thing is that if k is large compared to boson and the firing rate, then this here is a big repression, and you can get kind of a reasonable level of repressions. Oh yeah, that comes on top of it. So this is kind of just giving you the bulk part, but in this particular thing there's only 62 base pair between, so it's not that much. So that's some equations, and that's fine. So that's all fine, and the main thing is, well, maybe I should just show you that there is the main effect is that the repression or the effect of one unable or one promoter on another is depending on the relative promoter strengths. This is kind of the effect for factor 10 difference in strengths. This is for factor 20, and this is for factor 5. It kind of scales linearly with the ratio of these two promoters. And then it's kind of have a funny shape that depends on the property of the promoter you are attacking. The property of the promoter you are attacking is kind of very asymmetric. If there's a lot of if the on rate is very different from the firing rate, then you are kind of out in the tails here. And then you're not possible to inference it. So to have a good inference, you need to be in the middle. So there's a design feature of promoters that kind of go by on just how strong they are. There also is a design that tells you how much you spend in the relative to non-equilibrium state. Okay. That's all fine, but that's not really bringing us all the way, because that was a model for how long time do we have? Okay, that's fine. Okay, something like that. Yes, sure. So we want to do it a little bit better, because we need to have transcription factors, and that means that we have to look at, and that's Ian and Keith has worked a lot on finding out how this transcription factor is actually playing a game in the system, and the main part or main feature here is that the transcription factor is forming a 14 mere. So that they know, and it kind of so it looks like this here, and it binds to the DNA here. It has three binding sites here, and it's on the same time can also bind over there. I'll come some evidence for that. So it looks something like this here, where PR sits like there and PL sits over there. That's kind of how the RNA polymerase bind to this system. How the C1 bind. And that is kind of nice to have that knowledge when you start building a model, because that simplifies number of players you have to deal with. Let me make. Here is some evidence. So binding of the crystallizer structure of the C1 of the inner part of the wheel there. So that's one part of the evidence. They won't know the binding of C1 to PL. So let me go up here. So there was PR and PL. The binding, how much C1 binds there and represses one, is very sensitive to the helix turn, the number of DNA helix turns to PL. So if you just turn it five base pair, then you change the repression on PL. So that means that it goes all that it senses that it's a structure that binds to PR that also influences PL. So it's a cooperative structure in that way. So that was some evidence. So let me. So this is one element in the model: transcription factor binding like this to the DNA in question here. The transcription factor is not the only part of this game. The RNA polymerase is another part. And the RNA polymerase we model in a three-step model. There's an equilibrium step, the closed complex. This is an open complex, and this is an elongating complex. So this is how you should treat a real transcription initiation according to the standard model of McClure, like from 82 or something like that. And there's a little bit mathematics how these different rates adds up to the total rate of this of normal elongation initiation, and that's kind of fairly trivial. Now you want to combine these two things, where you have two promoters firing against each other, and then you have a lot of transcription factors that can bind different cases. Well, the transcription factor can bind there, and it can wrap, this piece of DNA can be wrapped up. So you have different states in the system, and you can certainly deal with the transcription factor binding there and wrapping this one up, or not wrapping it up, with something that has to do with the binding between this piece and the wheel sitting there. And there's a binding for this wheel sitting there, and there's a Hill coefficient for forming the wheel. So then you have some parameters, and you can do a full statistical calculation with these three parameters that you don't know, but you can kind of estimate what is the probability that this one is, for example, having a RNA polymerase binding. You also have RNA polymerase that goes to the closed complex, which is also equilibrium. So you have equilibrium calculation of this kind of ensemble of states, which is kind of RNA polymerase sitting in one place or the other, or kind of C1 sitting there and wrapping up, or whatever it is. That's kind of a little equilibrium simulation, and from that bit, some probability that RNA polymerase, for example, sit there. And then there's a chance that this here, equilibrium world, somehow we call it, is transferred to another equilibrium world, which is definitely not equilibrium with that one itself, because that has to do with the closed complex at this point is converted into an open complex. And this cannot go back due to equilibrium reaction. It can go back due to a non-equilibrium reaction where this one is firing. So if this starts to be elongating, then of course it doesn't sit there anymore, and then you have the old situation left. You can go through and do this for all these different worlds, and in between there's some transition rates that has to do with what is the kind of non-equilibrium rates in the system, given that you are where you are. And all this kind of thing is in order to avoid doing a stochastic simulation. And we want to avoid doing a stochastic simulation because we want to do a kind of, we don't know the parameters, we want to somehow scan kind of a situation where we sample, we have like 6-8 parameters here for the different situations, and then we have statistical weights and we sample, and then we want to find the best fit. And that takes some time. So we get some parameters, this is kind of the parameters we have in the game, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 parameters, which has to do with the promoter properties, this has to do with the transcription factor properties, this has to do with RNA binding affinity, RNA polymerase binding affinity, and this has to do with this aspect ratio, how much you are in one the transition from closed to open and open to elongating. A lot of technical details. Anyway, with that one, you can kind of scan all the different possible solutions and see if you can fit one particular set of data, and the one we want to fit is essentially this red curve, which was FR minus, well, it's this dot that's the data, and the black curve is our fit in the first round when we have tried tests for 10,000 or 100,000 different solutions. So this is not a perfect fit to that curve. And we kind of wondered a lot what to do, because it's kind of something wrong in our way of thinking here. We have a basic model which has taken all this RNA polymerase, taking basically everything we could imagine into consideration. When we have RNA polymerase, we have transcription factors, we allow all kind of bindings and whatever. We realized that there was one thing we didn't allow for, and that was this funny thing that when RNA polymerase is not just a kind of like binding somewhere and then moving along, but it has this intermediate open complex state, and that is a kind of intermediate that open for new regulatory kind of repertoire. So if RNA polymerase in an open complex is suddenly doing something different than when you do it in the closed complex, then you're actually kind of doing some, it's a different logic than when you do it in a closed. For example, if an RNA polymerase that binds to the promoter is interacting with a transcription factor, in closed complex. It's equilibrium binding, and it effectively means that this RNA polymerase is going to be recruited by the transcription factor. But if the RNA polymerase instead interacts with the transcription factor in the open complex, it does not get recruited. But when it is recruited, then it will recruit the open complex, the transcription factor. And that was kind of the key to solving it, so that the RNA polymerase in open complex has some it's some abilities in sitting there that made it possible for us to solve. I go through some logics here that you would not probably would not like to hear about. But it's basically the overall context is that the RNA polymerase in open complex, open for some new games on not only games like RNA polymerase getting ejected, but also RNA polymerase. And what we suggest here, RNA polymerase in open complex on PL, act on C1, recruit a transcription factor to the opposing promoter. And when we do that, then we basically get the red curve here, which is reasonable. At least it's qualitatively reasonable that it goes up and falls down. And that's as good as I will do it now, because obviously there could be other things in the story. And so this is how we imagine it looks. RNA polymerase in open complex sitting here and kind of interacting with you can see the DNA is kind of opened here. RNA polymerase sit here, and here's the wheel. So this is kind of a fantasy Star Wars drawing. Yeah, that you see Starship Enterprise or something like that. And then I will not say any more, I think, except that, of course, there's additional layers on this here. So. Oh no, I think it's kind of fine. I'll just round off now somehow. I will just say that we actually let me see. We can repeat this little story and obviously you can continue this. The main point of this talk was this the last part here is this new ability of RNA polymerase at open complex. Then there's other small additions to the regulation that has to do with DNA looping, which is somewhat more trivial in some way. But the main thing is that open complex is a new tool, new game in town. Okay, so phages present system biology problems on all living scales, and I think I went through most of them. They provide genetic toolbox that's easily quantified. So as Ian's experiment show you, really very quantifiable. You can do mutations that you remove here and there, and you get very distinctive experiments. And you can actually sometimes find new kind of regulatory mechanism. I don't think anybody else has suggested this RNA polymerase in open complex recruiting a transcription factor. They are nearly mathematical objects. Kind of nearly think about them as logical decision circuits. And then actually, going back to the beginning of the talk, the middle of the talk, that it actually has this, you really have a genetic network here, which is sending signals, five steps, there's five links from one end, from the reg A to the other end. So you have an example of a network where you actually send signals, where there really is, in real life, sent a signal more than one step away, which is kind of, especially in physics community, highly underappreciated. All physicists, when they model networks in biology, they kind of typically use some model which is equivalent to which get richer, which is basically going one step away. This is a system where you go five steps away. And probably, here it's because we know it and it has been well studied, that really these networks are sending signals across themselves. And that's kind of a something to think about when we think about more complicated organisms where we actually anyway don't know what goes on. But probably sometimes signals are actually sent across these networks. And that's we have some examples of that. So I will end with that and maybe end with somewhat more questions. It's good to generate questions. There are a lot of why questions here. Apart from the existence questions that I always have addressed, there's a funny uniform or ubiquitous phenomena with all these phages, that they all have an anti-immune state. That means that when you take this phage and don't allow them to kill their host, then they are able to sustain or stay in this anti-immune. They're really bistable. They can stay in the system where you would have killed the host, and they can stay there for 100 generations. And that seems to be true for all the temporal phages. And it doesn't make any particular sense. It's actually quite difficult to get in modeling-wise, because it's a fairly fragile thing. But it seems that you need to kind of micro-manipulate this on a time scale of 100 generations anyway when you're going to do it in one generation, which is funny.
I don't understand. So, I mean, you have two strategies. One, you infect something and you make many more of yourself, maybe
yeah.
1,000 or
yeah.
1,000 or so.
100 only here.
100?
Yeah, 50 to 100. Which is also kind of we could have made 1,000, but for some reason the phages decide only to make typically between 50 and 100.
Okay, but if you infect a cell and then the cell replicates a number of times, and if you lysogenize a cell and the cell replicates a number of times, then you can make many more of yourself than if you just infect.
Yes, that's the idea in going to the lysogeny.
Yeah.
But if you go into the, if you have decided to kill the phage, kill the cell, then normally you do it somehow in 50 minutes. From end, if you decide that's kind of the time it takes to make this 50 copies. Now what is funny here was that you make this, now you make this artificial state where you have made an aborted phage that sits in the chromosome, and you have removed everything else than the main decision circuit. And then that can be maintained in its state where it would kill the cell if it was allowed to do it, and it can stay there for 100 generations before it spontaneously switches over. It's a bistable system which switch back and forth. And for some reason, this is a generic phenomenon for this phages, that it actually have this state and it's reasonably stable. For 186, it's completely it's kind of difficult to understand it also theoretically to get it to work, but they seem to have it for some reason. And it's one of these questions that I don't know any answer of, and I don't think anybody else does. I can say I'll end here. Okay, thank you.
Coexistence model, where you try to predict coexistence of two different types of viruses and bacteria. Varying the parameters, what do you normally get? Do you get?
You either get one or you get the other. But you, it sometimes.
Yeah. Bacteria, do you have solutions where a bacteria are killed?
Yeah, you also have that. Actually, I could, if it was, if I was locked in here, I could show you. It is. We have the model on the computer where you can check all this kind of stuff. So we kind of don't want to have you disbelieve. And here's some model on the it would have run up there if it was technology. So this is kind of ecology which is running. It's a game app which you can play with yourself on just logging into our homepage. And then you can try to change parameters and see what happens. And you see somehow typically that here's some arbitrary parameter. This is the parameter where it works best. This is the bacteria, this is the virulent phages, and this is the tempered phages.
I have a question.
Yes?
It's really about a small part of your talk, but I was fascinated by the divergence and sequence between these two phages. And,
yes?
And if there are hundreds of phages that we have sequenced for,
yes?
Have people done like reasonably careful attempts at putting phylogenies on these?
Yeah, there's some people that has that. Some, but it's this as a mosaic kind of thing is what people are talking about between. But yeah, and I don't.
So are there other ones that look more like 186?
Oh, yeah.
More like
yes. There's a lot. So the 186 belongs to this class. The more famous is P2. So that's a big group of them, and there's a big group of Lambdoid, Hong Kong 22 and P22, and that's all these numbers. I mean, it's just, but there's a.
So how many big groups are there?
This two together should count for 90% of phages, I think, that tempered phage in the cooling. So they are the two major groups.
Do they make chimeras often, or?
Or mixed together? I don't think the two, but I don't know. I don't think they these two groups mix, but I'm not certain. That could be checked.
But there's plenty of interesting mixing, right?
Oh, yeah.
In any class.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And I guess to what extent is that characterized, understood? So one can.
It typically comes in cassettes. I think you in the lambda phase you will have the whole immunity region. So everything that involves the main players, that they are going to be shifted by the main players from somebody else.
But just to understand that in the state of affairs. So for example, you take your Q and M and right, so a few important nodes and. Do we know what, I shouldn't say orthologs, whether the homologs of those things are, right? And then you can do a tree of whatever, anti-terminators, a tree of, you have to give them a functional
identity.
And then compare these trees.
I've not seen that, but I think that could of course be done. I'm not certain whether it hasn't been done, but
can it be done?
Yes, it can be done.
State of affairs is that
you would always say that it's a very small fraction of phages you're looking at, but for the phages you have, it would be kind of simple.
But for example, suppose one wants to find these functional analogs of Q.
Yes.
So clearly, I can't find them just by looking by blasting, right? Because they're very different from each other.
I'm not,
do I find them? Is there some database? Is there some table which says that here AI is known in lambda page?
I think you're
all already terminated.
I'm not sure where we are. Where you probably have to. It's not some system where it actually you know that it sits out on the right side somewhere in the genome. But what is actually the Q in this XX phase? That would probably not be that easy.
Right. So position is conserved, or more or less conserved.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
On the chromosome. Order of what extent is the order? Right. So one of the things about these phages that's supposed to be able to recombine, presumably the important thing is chromosomal order.
Yeah.
So what extent?
How are that somehow?
Also, do they have? Is everything mosaic? Do they have something more homologous? I don't know, capsid proteins, something more conserved that.
I don't know. So
is some good review of.
No. There's not very much review of this. This is a very scattered. It's a small community which are not really into this bioinformatics. So there's a home.
That they all know, but they don't really care.
It's kind of rough, and you have to pick up the data by talking to them. That's. I don't know. No. Not even all know it. Everybody has a story.
I think on this topic, maybe it's a little bit on the fringe, but what about this metagenome type of projects there, in the sense that they're going into the soil and pouring into a little bit of mud and just sequencing anything they can? And I got the impression that early projects of this type were really dedicated to phage analysis, and that they were basically seeing sequence phase in terms of you can identify the protein coding part that no one had ever seen before. So
that's
blowing apart the idea that you even have maybe 1,000 domains. And, who knows?
Yes, is much greater
than anybody has ever seen.
I don't know how put this in connection with the phages and how you see whether that is actually has something to do with the phages or its bacteria or whatever. It has not really been kind of put in order. It's you just get a lot of sequences and there's an entropy question in sorting it. But I don't know.
No further questions.